The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Sian Kane, and this is the Guardian Books podcast. On this week's show, we're talking to Orhan Pamuk and Nicole Krauss. Nicole is best known for her novel The History of Love, which was shortlisted for the Orange Prize. Her new novel, Forest Dark, is her first for 7 years, following a novelist called Nicole, who becomes embroiled in the mysterious life of Kafka. We'll be hearing from Nicole later. But first, we talk to Turkey's best-known novelist, Orhan Pamuk, winner of the 2006 Nobel Prize in Literature. Pamuk's 10th novel, The Red-Haired Woman, explores themes of marital betrayal and a father-son relationship in 1980s Turkey. A well digger hires 16-year-old Cem to become his apprentice and search for water on the outskirts of Istanbul. One day, while resting, Cem becomes transfixed by a red-haired actress with tragic consequences. Claire met Orhan and began by asking him where the idea for his book came from.
I saw these people. I followed their work. It's based on what I observed in reality. In the summer of 1988, a couple like this, as I describe in a novel, digging a well. After a while, they ask, "Sir, can we use your water? Can we have some electricity?" So a sort of friendship or relationship developed. And as I left the island and as they were finishing the well, I did an interview with the old guy who told me this story in a different version, where in a barren land, he looked for water in the western peripheries of Istanbul and couldn't find it. And the drama stayed with me. And then I researched the subject and thought about it for almost 30 years and understood that what stayed with me was the father-son relationship, the occasional tenderness of the father and occasional strong repression of the boy by the father. Perhaps because my father was absent in my life and was a very soft, gentle person, never scolded me. But I thought of, what if I had a strong father like that? How would he be like? These were my initial questions as I begin to think about my imaginary story.
So the story of fathers and sons leads you into three dimensions, really. There's the very physical story of a boy working with a man who is, for the period in which they work together, i.e. digging the well, is a sort of surrogate father. Then you have the, it takes you deep into mythology and into two rival mythologies, one of which is Oedipus, and one of which is a Turkish, it was Iranian story, actually, which we don't really know about.
But first, wells are such a deep source for old stories because wells are like treasures, especially in my part of the world, in Middle East, that make even civilizations. If you have an empty land, if you don't have it, it doesn't mean anything. If you have a land and a river or water, wow, you can make a civilization out of it. And since it's essential to any kind of human happiness, Bible, Quran, had all stories with wells. Joseph and his brothers is about also throwing jealously your brother into well, so forth and so on. While once my imagination moved toward old stories, yes, I tried to relate my story with Oedipus Rex, that is a story of a parricide, the son killing the father, and a story that I read very carefully when I was writing My Name is Red, a novel based on pictures and the text that the pictures are illustrations of, essentially about classical period of Islamic painting and literature. And I love the story of Rustam and Suhrab, perhaps because it was a mirror image of Oedipus and his father, which I have read as a student in American high school in Istanbul. My book is, in indirect way, is related to these, but I wrote this also to be able to write about the red-haired woman.
The red-haired woman, who we haven't even mentioned,
yes,
who is the trigger
for everything.
Let's go
into her now.
Everything that happens.
Let's talk about the red-haired woman now. First,
a woman of the theater.
I wrote about the mysterious woman in the theater in my earliest Snow. And there, she was not that mysterious. She was a down-to-earth, strong woman involved in politics. I like these people's theaters, especially very popular in Turkey, 60s and 70s. Also, Turkish films use these as also these characters as figures. This novel is, and like the previous novel, is also Museum of Innocence is busy with Turkish films too. So with the help of the Ten Theater and mysterious red-haired woman, I combined father and son story with a woman, perhaps unlike Turgenev's story, First Love. But what is in that story, the boy is mysteriously in love with a neighbor, with a girl his age. Many years later, he realizes, maybe I won't tell that ending too.
There's a big statement by the red-haired woman about the fact that she'd chosen to be a red-haired woman and what that meant.
Yes, one of the most popular questions I've been asked after the publication of this book in Turkey is, why did you write about the red-haired woman in the end? The book is based, has three chapters. In the first two, we revisit these old stories through the eyes of a man. And in the end, I also said to myself, Oedipus, yes, Rustam and Suhrab, yes, but these are all men's stories. We are paying attention to drama of the men. The women are behind and they're crying and crying and crying. So I wanted to, this time, see the story through women's eyes and add a bend, surprising bend to the story from that voice. In fact, the red-haired woman's monologue at the end of the book adds a new surprise to the detective story or to the thriller. And this is also parallel to the fact that Oedipus Rex is actually a detective story where Oedipus is in search of the person who killed his father but later realizes it is himself. The book Red-Haired Woman has this kind of metaphysical inquiry and fastness, but I can say that it's a fictional inquiry into the literary origins of civilizations, or in fact inquiry into literary origins of individualism, which is Oedipus Rex, and authoritarianism in my part of the world, which is Rustam and Suhrab.
So there are all sorts of resonances, and we've talked about Rustam and Suhrab, we've talked about Oedipus Rex. The red-haired woman is at once she's the mother of Oedipus, but she's also Gabriel Rossetti's muse. So she's both passive and active.
Here I should underline the fact that the meaning of red-haired woman is different in my part of the world and here. First, now that I'm here for this book, my God, how many red-haired women I see in streets of London or in England. But here, red-haired woman is, as in Sylvia Plath's poem, is uncontrollable, angry, strong woman who may be scheming things, and he has a mysterious, angry voice. While in my part of the world, since you don't biologically see too many red-haired women, mostly it's, first of all, dyed hair. So the red-haired woman is more artificial, maybe playing in movies or maybe an actress. She is not very much one of us, but also she is different. Yes, again, she is strong. She has definitely had character, obviously, but she may also have easy virtue. Perhaps you may sleep her with more easily. So there is that meaning in my part of the world about red-haired women. Add to the fact that you choose your character when you decide to dye your hair red, you also choose a character. That is the interesting part that I develop, that underline the fact that although my red-haired woman is politically pressured, is living a bad life, she is not passive, she is strong. And I also did the same thing in A Strangest in My Mind. Although women are repressed, perhaps through religion, many, many authoritarian attitudes by macho men, but they are not crushed, they fight back. They tell their stories as in A Strangest in My Mind. Or as here, they control demons. They go into classical stories and turn them inwards out, so to speak.
Part of this novel is a look at the history of the left in Turkey, the backstory of Cem's father. And it's very much connected with revolutionary cells.
Especially Maoists, whom I knew in early 1970s.
So
I had many Maoist friends.
You still live in Turkey. How free are you? Because I know we hear an awful lot about people, writers being imprisoned.
But we have to make a distinction. First, the general facts. After the horrible military coup last year, now 50,000 people are put in jail, some of them with very arbitrary accusations. More, 200 or 180-190 journalists are in jail, some of them my friends, novelist friends. But my friends are not there for their novels. They're there for criticizing the government too much, criticizing Erdogan or whoever too much. This is unacceptable. Turkish democracy is narrowing and narrowing and narrowing. The government is using the horrible military coup as a good excuse to get rid of opposition. And if you don't have free speech, yeah, my understanding is that you will not have democracy. Some people are writing in pro-government newspapers, we are inventing Turkish democracy, implying that Turkish democracy, this new thing, will be a democracy without free speech. Of course, I'm telling this with irony, but it won't work out. We will see what will happen.
I was wondering the extent to which this political situation that is particular to Turkey or your part of the world dictates the form of your fiction, which is the way that you use fable, for example, which has been such an important part.
I plan ahead my novels. They also said to me, wow, after Nobel Prize, you've produced another book fast. Well, I was in the middle of that book. This novel, as I told you, I was thinking of for 30 years. But maybe as I wrote the book, I alluded to the growing authoritarianism in Turkey, and I wrote the novel not in a complaining mood, but also in a more anthropological interest, kind, try to understand the common authoritarian attitudes in my part of the world. So relating them to other deeper necessities. I'm, of course, critical of horrors that are inflicted on people, but then, for me, a writer is interesting if he tries to understand why is this happening rather than condemn what is happening.
You're listening to the Guardian Books podcast. Nicole Krauss's new book, Forest Dark, consists of two alternate stories. Jules Epstein is a wealthy man who sets off for the Tel Aviv Hilton in search of transformation. Nicole is a novelist, struggling with her new book. She leaves her husband and children behind in Brooklyn and heads for the same hotel in Israel, where she learns a secret about Kafka. He faked his death and lived a long life on a kibbutz in Palestine. I met Nicole and began by asking her about the character Nicole, who writes, has two sons, and is recently separated from her husband, much like Krauss, who in real life was married to the writer Jonathan Safran Foer. How much of her is in the fictional Nicole?
I think as people we tend naturally to somehow prioritize the real over the imagined, because we think somehow it's more meaningful, it's more true, perhaps. And in writing this character who has my name and who has at least the outward appearance of my life, I think I was deliberately trying to provoke questions about that valuing of the real over the imagined. Why, when we know that if you sit across from me as you are now, and it would be you who I were interviewing, and you would tell me the story of what's happened to you on your vacation or in the last 10 years of your life, if we were really pressed, we would know that that would be a kind of fictional narrative. Not that you were not telling the truth. You're telling me the truth as you know it. But it's the tapestry of your memories, which are, frankly, you know, fictional constructs, and perceptions which come out of your own consciousness, which is not a record of any objective reality, right? So in writing the story about Nicole, who looks like me, the truth is that some of the most seemingly surreal and spectacular things that happened to her are the most real things in my life, and some of the more pedestrian details are not, and also vice versa, because at a certain point, the novel takes on, her particular story takes on such a fantastical turn when the story of Kafka and his afterlife is brought into it, that the reader has to begin to question, okay, all this time I have made the assumption that this is autobiography, but no, it must be something else. And in arriving at that, you realize, wait a minute, like how much truth do we get from the fictional world? I mean, we turn to literature, right, to shed light on this life and this world and to give us news of who we are, even though we know that world to be fictional. So then we sort of return to the idea of valuing that and what it can do for our sense of ourselves.
Epstein and Nicole at various points end up in Israel. And I was wondering what your relationship with is with Israel, because, I mean, certainly in fiction, very often we do particularly encounter American Jewish writers exploring their relationship with either their religion or their culture or with Israel. And it's often quite complex.
I think it's an increasingly complex relationship. Israel is a country and a society that is engaged with the invention of itself. It's a very live and urgent invention, self-invention. You feel it very much, particularly now in Tel Aviv, which is a city which in the last 10, 15 years has really become a kind of counterculture, a counterpoint to the rest of the sort of mainstream Israeli society, and the place where creative people are making, you know, new music and art and food, all of which is reflecting a kind of Middle Eastern reality and a Jewish existence in an Arabic context rather than a European context. And so the result of that is that American Jews and European Jews still in diaspora can no longer claim Israel as an extension of their own reality, nor their own idea. I mean, Israel has really hijacked the narrative of itself, in a sense, and just at a time when modern Hebrew has really caught up with the conditions of the existence there. So I think that, you know, the novel always goes right toward confusion, it goes towards heat and what's most undecided and therefore, you know, most alive. And I think that's why you see Jewish American writers grappling with that in their work.
And the Tel Aviv Hilton, which, by the way, I'm very glad you included pictures of in the book, because I love a brutalist building, and that is a doozy of a building. I mean, did you actually have any relationship with that building? Or was it just sort of one that stuck out in your mind? Because it is very distinctive.
No, I've been going there since I was a child.
Oh, really?
And my parents got married at the Tel Aviv Hilton, and it was just a kind of anchor of my childhood in a quite literal way. And I think what drew me to it now, drew me back to it, was just that, the fact that you could have this enormous brutalist building, which is quite monolithic. I mean, it although the coast of Tel Aviv is quite built up now, it still stands alone where it is and sort of cantilevered, you know, on the shore there. And it's so imposing, and it's so, you know, you look at it and you remember that idea that architecture really directs our lives. It tells us how to move through space and therefore does all kinds of other things to us on a psychological level too. And yet the things that had happened to me there as a child, some of which I do describe in the book, were quite magical and quite otherworldly, let's say, outside the realm of what we talk about, as we were talking before, when we think of sort of traditional, conventional reality. So things that sort of really pushed my sense of the magical and what should and shouldn't be possible in the world. And so I was interested by that. So in a sense, that imposing building had this incredible flexibility in my experiences there. And I suppose I began to see it as a sort of portal to other worlds.
I mean, it's actually a really it's sort of almost like a trope sometimes in fiction, particularly sort of horror, slightly like that uncanny sort of sense. I'm thinking particularly there's a particular Murakami novel set in a hotel, which has that exact sort of sense of that it is a portal. It's a sort of a doorway to other things. This big building that's got so many doors in it.
And normally hotels are so impersonal, right?
Yeah.
Because they're nobody's home and they're full of itinerant souls. But again, in my case, I felt my relationship to this brutalist building was actually deeply personal, because my parents married there. For all I know, I was conceived there. I've been going back there since I was a child. And these remarkable things had happened to me. Like, for example, you know, my brother and I used to swim in the pool at the Hilton. One year, we just discovered all these coins at the bottom. And so we started this game of diving for them. And my brother would dive and I would try to spot them. He was a bit older than I was and a better diver. And then, I don't know, one afternoon, it was sort of like, you know, the end of our time in the pool. And we sort of hadn't found anything else for a while. And I just had this urge to make him happy, you know, to delight him. And I sort of, you know, pointed, there it is, this one right there. And then he came rushing over and went down. And I just had this dark sense of guilt because I knew I had just, you know, there was nothing down there. He was going to come up empty-handed. And then he came up, and as I describe in the book, I mean, I cannot explain what happened after that beyond saying that, you know, how we think about the world may be too narrow, you know, that we've kind of fit the world to fit our ability to understand it. But he had in his hand this earring that was three tiny little diamonds and a little ruby heart at the bottom. And I went rushing to my mother. My mother, you know, went rushing us through the, as I remember it, through the frigid lobby of the Hilton. And there was a jeweler in the lobby, an H. Stearns. And we brought it to him, put it on his velvet line tray. And he looked at it and he said, real. It's real. You know, it's 18 carat. And I think for me, that was such a profound experience because, of course, I hadn't been concerned with whether it was real or not, only I knew exactly how unreal that earring was, and how I had kind of willed it into existence.
And I suppose that sense of possibility is also in the storyline involving Kafka, which is that it all revolves around the what happened to Kafka's papers after. Because would you mind sort of explaining in case people don't know what happened to his papers after?
Of course. So the story that's most well known about Kafka's papers is that in 1939, he died in Prague in 1924, and in 1939, his closest friend who had inherited the papers, Max Brod, jammed them all into a suitcase and got in the last train out of Prague as the Nazis were entering. And he ended up going to what was then Palestine, Tel Aviv, and he began from there to publish Kafka's work. And he died eventually, and the rest of whatever hadn't been published or whatever original manuscripts and letters in Kafka's hands he possessed were handed down to his secretary, and she then passed them on to her two daughters. And so the result is that these papers, for many, many years, were in an apartment in Tel Aviv on Spinoza Street, living alongside about 30 stray cats, which they're, you know, the woman, the daughter, also kept. So then there was a court case in Israel, and that case actually lasted 8 years. It went through various courts.
I think we covered it like every year for about five.
Did you? Right. Yeah. So it was you know, the National Library on the one hand, National Library of Israel, which felt that the papers belonged with them, versus Eva Hoff, the woman who was in possession of them and felt that they were hers, that she had a right to them. Who does Kafka belong to, didn't interest me as much as the feeling that I would have when I would stand on Spinoza Street and look at this apartment, which has, you know, it's a ground floor apartment, so it has bars in the windows, and then behind that, another mesh kind of cage. And I couldn't help but feel this question of, is it Kafka that's imprisoned in there? That Kafka, whatever is original or still his and only his, inside there and it being kept in that small jail with all those cats? Or is it us on the outside of those bars who's kept from accessing them and touching them, though we sort of, if we yearn for them, we love Kafka so much. And then, you know, in the moment you start to think about imprisonment or entrapment, you can't also help but think about the flip side, which is escape. I started to think about how Kafka, you know, although the story that Max Brod sort of handed over to the public about Kafka, and of course he was largely in control of that story because he wrote Kafka's biography and edited Kafka's work, so he really handed us our sense of who Kafka was, which hasn't been altered all that much. A little bit now that some more interesting full biographies have come out, but in a sense that version of Kafka was a martyr who ultimately died of the things which he couldn't escape: his overbearing father, the need to work in the insurance agency, the sort of expectations of that difficult, you know, Prague urban society in which he lived. and of course the tuberculosis that ultimately killed him. And yet when you read Kafka, you can't help but feel that he escaped. He absolutely escaped, A, because we're still reading him all these years later, but even just in the work, like if you think of a story like The Hunger Artist, you know, The Hunger Artist starves himself, and he's a spectacle in that self-starvation. And in the end, you know, he's in a cage, and people come to see him, and in the end he dies of it. But you can't help but feel that it's him, the hunger artist, who escapes, and it's his keeper and the spectators who don't, who are sort of imprisoned by their own sense of the world. And so then I just started thinking about Kafka and that sense of escape, and I found that just as I was writing about these escapes or transformations, this kind of find of Epstein and Nicole, you know, sort of escaping through a crack in the door to something larger, I guess, more infinite than the one finite life we're given. I started to think about Kafka, the possibility of Kafka's escape, and so then it became this idea of this other imagined existence in which Kafka didn't die in 1924, but it was actually secreted out of Prague to Palestine, where he sort of lived out his life and wrote in this kind of afterlife of Hebrew, and lived as an unknown gardener, and eventually moved to the desert.
I mean, all of this sort of feeds into there's this little theme running throughout the book, particularly with Nicole as well, that this debate whether the artworks belong to the artist, does it belong to the culture around it? And there's a few instances, and I really loved one with Nicole, where she's told by someone who's read her books, that it's as good as spitting on Hitler's grave. Never mind that he doesn't have one. And I was wondering if you ever had that sort of similar encounter with fans, because there's another bit that Nicole has where a character comes and says that she's named a baby after one of her characters. And I mean, it must be quite unsettling to put something out in the world and then it has its own life of its own.
I very much feel that is how things work in art, and that is so much the beauty of art. So, I mean, just imagine, like, whoever wrote the Book of Genesis, that genius, whoever he or she was, we have no idea what that book really was because it's probably been so thoroughly edited to be almost unrecognizable. However, whatever he or she intended, that book has become a million things since, and it continues to be relevant because we keep filling it with our own meaning, and that meaning changes through thousands of years. And that's an extreme example. I think it's the same with Kafka, which is just 100 years. But I do think that once something leaves the artist's hands and goes out into the world, it no longer belongs to him or her. It belongs to the culture, to the readers, and they fill it with meaning. And the beauty of that is that it deepens whatever the author's intentions were. The author couldn't possibly have intended all of those things. So it gets richer and richer and richer. I thought about this today because I was just at Kenwood House, and there's a beautiful Rembrandt self-portrait there that I just love so much. It must be like the most beautiful painting that you have here in London. And you think, like, that was painted in 1665 or something. And Rembrandt must have meant many things, but he couldn't have meant all of those things that it means to all of us every time we go to see him and look at him there. I love that. I love that I can somehow be a very small part of that process.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. Many thanks to Nicole and Orhan. The Red-Haired Woman by Orhan Pamuk is published by Faber, and Forest Duck by Nicole Krauss by Bloomsbury. Next week, we'll be talking to Maria Alokhina from Pussy Riot and Canadian-Egyptian novelist Omar El-Erkad. In the meantime, you can join in the discussion on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast, which is also how you'll find us on your favourite podcast app. But now, from me, Sian Kane, and our producer, Simon Barnard, thank you for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.